welcome to the WIFPICS World PICU Awareness Week podcast series. I'm Karen Chung, a pediatric intensivist from McMaster Children's Hospital in Hamilton in Canada. It is a great privilege to have with me today Dr. Heidi Smith. Dr. Smith is a professor of anesthesiology and pediatrics at Vanderbilt University Medical Center and is a world-renowned expert on delirium and neurobehavioral outcomes following critical illness. She created and validated the preschool and pediatric confusion assessment methods for the ICU, the PS and PCAM ICU, a widely used tool for the assessment of PICU delirium. Heidi, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Karen. This is such an honor, and I think it will be a lot of fun to just sit down and talk about this really important problem.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. Heidi, as this is PICU Awareness Week, perhaps you can start by giving us some perspective. A lot of attention has been drawn to delirium in adults. Do you think that as a PICU community, we have an adequate awareness and understanding of this problem in critically ill children?
You know, in the beginning, it was a little painful for all of us to admit what we had missed. You know, we just didn't know what we didn't know, so to speak. But it was really no one's fault per se. And I think all of us as pediatricians focusing on being willing to learn and change practice for the improvement of patient care really has led to the just amazing data that we have created and developed over the past decade with the implementation of delirium screening to better understand the problem. And I think overall, people do not argue that the prevalence of delirium is can be seen in rates of up to 60% on those receiving mechanical ventilation and in the very young. I think there's also a real understanding that delirium is associated with key, both in-hospital and out-of-hospital, poor outcomes, such as prolonged duration of mechanical ventilation, longer ICU and hospital length of stay, and then also issues with poor quality of life scores once home, risk of higher PTSS symptoms at home, including impact of patient families. So I think there's a recognition of the issue. However, if you look over time of the prevalence of delirium, it hasn't abruptly changed in our ICUs. And so I think when we talk about awareness, it is that next phase of we know it, we know what it is, we know that it occurs, we are screening for it, and we're initially starting to make steps towards how do we combat it, but we cannot lose vigilance on what that looks like. And so I think there remains a tendency to believe that you can easily tell who has delirium without using a validated tool, and that has to stay out of our practice. We need to utilize these validated tools and do it consistently. Now, while I would agree that there are symptoms that are often associated with delirium that may in fact be delirium, agitation has become synonymous with delirium, and agitation is a symptom. So this can be due to pain, fear, anxiety, delirium, iatrogenic withdrawal. So again, we have to help our nursing partners to recognize the importance of using these tools and doing it in a consistent way.
You've mentioned so many important things about really kind of in a couple of sentences outlining the history and evolution of delirium, where we've come to being skeptics of delirium to believing that it really does exist, or at least starting to understand that delirium is a very important differential diagnosis for agitation. You touched on screening, and I think that is perhaps one of the most challenging aspects of practice and implementation aspects of the liberation bundle. How should we screen for and diagnose and monitor critically ill children with delirium?
Well, you have really not just two, but two great options for assessing for delirium in both neonates, younger infants, and preschool and school-age children. And that's the preschool pediatric confusion assessment method for the ICU and the CAPD, both very reliable and valid tools. Both of these tools, again, can be used for screening for delirium. And I think sometimes the focus becomes on which tool is better versus just screen for delirium. Now, on a side note, I think it's been really interesting to see the ongoing struggle of how to best implement the use of delirium monitoring. So there is a focus on in-the-moment assessment, and then there is more of an overall screening for delirium. So did it happen over a nurse's shift? Herein lies the concern is that, especially in younger patients, the symptoms that you have, such as, let's just say, inattention or agitation, can be from pain. And if you treat that those symptoms with pain medication and that those symptoms go away and the pain score improves, how do you tease that out when you're doing your delirium assessment potentially 4 hours away from those symptoms that you recognized earlier as pain? So I think, again, screening is just that. It is screening that then you then further assess or reassess what's going on with the patient. And therefore, you look at what was the trend in pain scores, what has been the level of consciousness, what were the iatrogenic withdrawal scores as well. So I think the main thing that I want to say about screening is that in some ways, we make it sound like delirium screening is easy, which I would say use of the CAPD and use of the CAM-ICU for PEDS, those tools in general are easy. But I don't think we can ever walk away from the discussion about delirium and make it sound like assessment of the brain is easy. Because in children in particular, the assessment for level of consciousness, pain, and delirium and iatrogenic withdrawal to some degree have to be considered together and not just as separate entities, because so many of the symptoms can overlap. Part of the problem, which can be easily remedied, is just pick a tool and start doing it.
Thank you for explaining to us really what is a complex concept and how do we make sure this is routine. And I really liked what you said, and this is something that we've done it in our centers. Do not make it optional. This is a mandatory part of your vital sign assessment of every single patient every day, starting from the day that they come in. And then the other important aspect and tips for others who are choosing a tool is look at all the tools, choose the one that you think is most feasible and appropriate to implement in your institution.
And along with ease of implementation, recognize kind of the shortfalls of that tool, meaning what is it really telling you? And then be willing to dive a little deeper to come to the truth, right? So again, I think that just because we screen and we say, yep, we screened positive or negative, that's not enough, right? The patient deserves more than that. Just like if we were to get a test that came back positive on your lab, sometimes it means something. Other times you're like, well, in this setting with all of this other evidence, maybe it means something different and we need to go to the bedside and reassess. And I think that's what is important is reassessing.
Absolutely. Those are really important points because we always talk about there's screening and then there's diagnosis. One other thing that we found important in our practice is also understanding what the tool does. So when you screen positive, look at the components of why they screen positive. And ultimately, they actually may be a role for both tools, which we sometimes consider in our institution. Are there specific populations in whom the diagnosis is challenging? And what is your recommendation there?
I think the history of how we developed the pediatric series for the CAM-ICU really gets to one of the main concerns that I've had from the beginning, which is how do you accurately assess for delirium in neonates and the very young? And so that's why when we created the pediatric CAM-ICU series, we started with patients 5 years of age, developmentally and older. And that is the pediatric CAM-ICU, because even at that time, our reference standard, which was our child and adolescent psychiatrist, they were beginning this journey with us. They were not consistently diagnosing delirium in the pediatric patient, let alone the ICU environment, which many of our colleagues will tell you, I don't know if the right word is frightened, but it's a scary place. It makes you uncomfortable, especially when you're not in there on a regular basis, which now luckily our psychiatry colleagues are with us and consulting with us on a more regular basis. But because of that, we really had to step back and make sure that the items that we were using or the way in which we were assessing for those cardinal features, particularly inattention, were both developmentally appropriate and could be reliable and consistent across those ages. So once we had validated the PCAM-ICU, that's when we went back to start to think about how do we now mirror this in younger patients where developmentally there were going to be struggles. And so the preschool CAM-ICU was actually then validated in two separate populations, 6 months of age and up to 5 years, and then neonates up to 6 months of age. And some of the key things that we had to recognize in those patient populations, especially neonates, is when do you assess for delirium? When do you assess for pain and even level of consciousness? So I think the very young recognition that their sleep cycle is different, postprandial periods are different, and we just want to assure that what we are assessing is real. Developmental delay. So patients with developmental delay, you need to assure that you're using the right tool. And when I say the right tool, it's more for the pediatric CAM-ICU. It becomes, are they developmentally older than five or are they less than five? Even if, let's say, that chronologically they're 8 years of age. So taking into consideration that. Colmer and colleagues did a very nice study looking at delirium diagnosis in patients with and without developmental delay. And they compared what their CAPD scores were at baseline at the time of diagnosis. And they found that just at baseline, their scores were already higher. And then their scores for delirium were also higher when you compared those to neurotypical ICU patients. And so the challenge here is, how do we assess for delirium in these patients? And when we score them, perhaps when they have a predisposed or pre-known diagnosis of developmental delay, perhaps we try to do a baseline delirium assessment, knowing that kind of what that score is, that we somewhat in some ways trend that over time. And then finally, I think patients with pediatric brain injury is another population that becomes important to not avoid delirium screening, even though people will argue, well, they've had this injury, and therefore, how do you know that what you're seeing is not just this injury versus delirium? And we've always included neurotrauma or neurocognitive patients in our validation studies, because what you'll see is that these injuries will become static, and so they will not fluctuate. Rarely. Now, obviously, right after a neurotrauma, you will see evolution within that first 24 to 48 hours of ongoing potential injury that makes that pediatric brain injury worse over time. But there will come times where that will become static, and then you'll begin to potentially see fluctuation. And so it is important to recognize that delirium superimposed on neurocognitive disorders is possible. It happens. And again, it's just you do the screen and you come together as a group to say, how does this really relate to this particular patient and what do we need to do about it?
Thank you, Heidi. What I'm hearing is some important take-home points in that there is a differential diagnosis to a screen positive patient that needs to consider the context, and that it's important to consider a longitudinal assessment and screening in addition to a point in time. But also that there is increasing evidence in the understanding of how we use these tools in select populations. You talked about in the beginning our evolution of our ability to detect delirium, the evidence that we know now with respect to the populations at risk and the prevalence, but that the prevalence hasn't really quite changed. What can we do? What can we do to prevent delirium from occurring in our patients?
So I think the answer is, to some degree, we'll never be able to completely prevent delirium. So I think the brain is just as at risk for dysfunction in the setting of critical illness. And when you think about poor perfusion, poor oxygenation, hypotension, infection, all of those things will at some point, if they're severe enough, will impact brain health. The question then becomes, well, how do we mitigate? If we know that the injury is going to happen, is there a way to mitigate some of that severity? And in some patients, potentially prevent it because they're on that line. And so how do we keep them from kind of going over that and then becoming delirious? Obviously, the focus becomes on the critical illness. And part of that mitigation of iatrogenic harm, we focus a lot on sedation. And I, in lieu of time, I will not say that sedation is not important. It is. I think the problem becomes is that we've become so focused on sedation as the problem that many people feel like delirium only occurs in the setting of sedation. And that is not true. It is an important piece that we start separating. Yes, sedation is important. Yes, our choice and our depth of sedation is important to try to mitigate iatrogenic harm, but we need to keep focused on those other pieces to the puzzle. And we use the acronym brain maps to try to bring this to a head, but you know, bringing oxygen, which is really the B element of our A to F bundle, reducing deliriogenic drugs or conditions, the atmosphere, so levels of sensory and emotional stimulation, that's the ICU environment, that's focusing on family engagement and empowerment, the F bundle of the A to F bundle, infection, inflammation, immobilization, getting at, again, early mobility and exercise, the E component to the A to F bundle, new organ dysfunction. So don't forget about hepatorenal insufficiency and the impact that that may have on the patient's ability to get rid of and metabolize sedatives or opioids that we're giving. But also you can, again, have that superimposed delirium on neurocognitive disorders. So don't forget about that in those particular patients. And then you have metabolic disturbances, patients being awake. So the sleep-wake cycle disturbance, the quote-unquote G part of the A to F bundle. Pain, so not enough analgesia, and then too much, that A part of the A to F bundle. And then sedation. So sometimes it's anxiety and the need for more management. Sometimes it's over-administration of a sedative, and sometimes it can be even residual anesthesia. But that is the C component of the A to F bundle. I think the prevention and management of delirium is the hardest part because it forces you, if you really are serious about it, to come back around in rounds multiple times a day, not big rounds, but little rounds, to say, hey, those other three things that we were going to try today, have we been able to do it? So I would say that is the struggle. And then I guess really the next question would be pharmacologic. But I think the big piece to this is recognizing that the brain is impacted by so many things about what's the stimulus coming in and the ability of the patient to communicate outwards.
Thank you. And everything that you've mentioned in terms of these preventative and management strategies are all evidence-based. And I think that in the epidemiology of delirium, when we start screening for it and diagnosing it, we can anticipate that the prevalence goes up. And I'm quite confident, and there is evidence from institutions that are very delirium-focused, that is absolutely achievable. You've really taught us a lot today, and I wanted to end by asking you, what do you think are the biggest challenges today for PICU-acquired delirium? How can or should we address this as a PICU community?
So I think one of the big struggles is we have to be willing to recognize that there's not a magic pill. So there isn't one. And there is a role for sedation in pediatric patients. It's just figuring out how do we push ourselves to allow the patient to be awake as possible, but again, mitigating harm. I think it's very interesting in a recent paper coming out looking at risk factors, the odds ratio for physical restraints was the same as the odds ratio for benzodiazepine and association with delirium. So focus on sedation, that's important, but I think sometimes we become super focused on one thing and forget about all these other things that impact delirium just the same. I think the other piece to it is recognizing that the use of atypical antipsychotics has a role, but we again have become too reactionary to where a delirium assessment is positive, we're going to then start atypical antipsychotics. And we don't have a plan for reassessment of whether or not it's helping. Is it helping you get off sedatives? If it is, then maybe that's a good thing. If it's not helping, then why are we continuing it? And then what is the goal for length of therapy? So I think we just have to be very careful about not focusing on the things that are actually demonstrating improvement in prevalence and rates of delirium, which are the brain maps or the A to F bundle, and just again trying to maybe focus on things that make us feel a little bit better that we're doing something for it. Mm-hmm. But it honestly, I still think there just has to be so much more evidence to support some of the practices that we're using now.
Thank you so much, Heidi. You've really helped us focus on the awareness in terms of the acute management and screening and how we can continue to work forward towards the prevention. What are your final messages with respect to awareness with respect to PICU delirium?
One of the most important areas, particularly for me, is understanding why ICU delirium matters. And I am concerned, among others, as whether or not delirium is associated with long-term cognitive and behavioral effects. We already know it impacts quality of life. There's concern for post-traumatic stress symptoms in both the patient and families. And this really alludes to not just how do we care for these patients, but how do we assure that we are assessing that this is occurring? So I am really excited to see post-intensive care syndrome clinics or PICS clinics and the role that they have in how we can interface with community pediatricians, recovery, rehabilitation medicine, psychologists, and psychiatrists to help ongoing recovery from brain dysfunction, including the psychological, cognitive, and functional toll of critical illness.
Thank you so much, Heidi, for helping us learn and be so much more aware about all the challenges and successes with respect to PICU delirium and what we need to work towards too, with respect to helping our PICU community understand our critically ill children better. It's been a real privilege and an honor for me to talk to you today. Thank you very much.